No, notice that what counts here is to actually do something in order. And you can't just do it in your imagination, and you can't just do it in thought. You have to do it in your life. That's why it takes 2 years. You can get an idea in a day. When the outline is there, I can put it on a single page. I can put it there symbolically, just like a mandala. I can paint that mandala now accurately to, you know, almost any degree of sophistication that you want. It doesn't do you any good. It's like me patting myself on the back. Well, man, look, you can finally say it. Look how beautiful that is. It doesn't do you any good at all. You have to be able to have put your livingness through it in that order so that that experience is yours. Then we can see eye to eye, and you can say, there's nothing in my eye that isn't in your eye. I don't have anything hidden that you don't also see in your own life. And that's what's important. And it's important to stick with it and do that. Once that's done, it's like any kind of a hierophantic religious experience. It's indelible because it has awakened capacities, not put anything there that wasn't there in the first place. All those capacities are part of your nature, and it's just a question of waking them up. But waking them up in that kind of a sequence that they occurred in the first place. And when they do, then you have something else. The only place where these two transformational continuums meet, where these two Mobius strips meet, they meet exactly in the deep self. So if you want to have some kind of a symbolic picture, you can think of the deep self as two Mobius strips perpendicular to each other meeting. It's like one of those symbols you used to see in the early 1950s, the atomic energy symbol. Mm-hmm. Only instead of having any atom at the center, you just have the orbits. And the orbits are two Mobius strips. Now think of these two Mobius strips occurring together, perpendicular always to each other. That's an accurate, truthful image of the deep self. Notice that there, at the center, there's nothing there. The center is made by virtue of the integrity of these two transformational processes happening coextensively. Now, in 20th century science, we call such a center a Bari center, B-A-R-Y-C-E-N-T-E-R, a Bari center. It's a center of all the forces, and there may not be some matter at the center, but all the forces have their focus there. And so the Bari center of the deep self actually occurs because of the integrity of these two transformational processes happening together. It's like if you took the double helix and curved it around and brought the ends together, that would be a very accurate kind of a symbolic picture of what the deep self is. The deep self is the focus of all the double helixes that can exist. And when you say something like that, it becomes astounding that each one of us is truly all the capacities of all the forms of life that could possibly be. And you can see that any imagination, any speculation about our dimensions is just paltry next to that. And you can also see the tremendous universal value that every individual really is. and what a waste it is for people to be thrown away by the hundreds of millions. Absolutely amazing. Going through this kind of educational unfoldment sensitizes you progressively to all of these capacities. Now, the one that we're at now, history, is perhaps the most difficult of all, because here we're trying to make thought available in its deepest ideas. When we did myths, we worked with images. Remember, we were doing images of last year, we were doing images of women in two different kinds of mythology. We're doing images of women in Greek mythology and images of women in Arthurian, Celtic mythology. And we took four images of women in Greek mythology and four images of women in Arthurian, Celtic mythology. And that those four images in each of those mythologies formed a whole called the feminine. There is a symbol of the feminine which is expressively embedded in Greek mythology. There's a symbol of the feminine expressively embedded in Arthurian Celtic mythology. They correlate. They correlate on the level of the symbolic. And we could have done the same thing for masculine. In history, though, we're trying to make conscious to ourselves aspects which were completely invisible at that time in mythology. Never occurred to us at all. Now they are occurring to us, and one of the dangers for us, that is to say, we experience a feeling that we interpret as danger, is that as we begin to sharpen our thought, we definitely have the intuition that our feeling sensitivity is being lessened, that we're losing touch with our feelings. This is not so in reality, but it seems like it's so in the very experience. And this is why human beings literally fear thought on this level. Bertrand Russell, in his History of Western Philosophy, said, men fear thought like the plague. They don't want to think, because when they get to a certain level, they realize that thought is wild. It's not constrained by the nice little pleasant lines that you thought it's written in. Thought will go in between the lines and off the page. It's a joker in the deck. It's as much a joker in the deck as feeling is. You can play for yourself a nice Baroque piece of music, like a Mozart divertimento, and you can enjoy the sinuosity of feeling. But if you realize that your feeling can go off the composition, it can go and explore areas that the divertimento never could have expressed, one can get a little scared about that. There's no limit to where feeling can go, just so there's no limit to where thought can go. What happens if we balk at something? We develop a kind of a phobic memory of that hitch, and we reinforce it every time we don't do it. And so we literally get into a situation of training ourselves specifically not to think about certain things. And the first thing that comes up is we train ourselves not to think about ourselves too deeply. What's the saying? You can go crazy thinking about that. But of course, by the time you're developed enough to be able to think about that, that's exactly what the deep self wants to think about. And so you enter a game of hide and seek with your real self. You get all kinds of distractions to hide in. Oh, I've got to do this. I've got to do that. Oh, I want to do this. But you're hiding from yourself. And the more that you play this hide-and-seek game, the more attenuated becomes the tension between you hiding and yourself seeking. But you're evenly matched, and to every extent that you develop hiding, the seeker finds a way to find you. And so the game, the ante of the game goes up and up and up, until finally you get into that kind of a situation best expressed by Franz Kafka. You get the sense that you wake up one morning and you're just an insect and not yourself. This kind of attention is symbolically characteristic of the loggerhead that comes when you refuse to go on with your life. You refuse to let your life develop. It's gotten to that stage. You wouldn't have those problems if you hadn't gotten to that stage in the first place. If it wasn't ripe for you, if you weren't mature enough to have those capacities, they wouldn't come up. You're never given 101% problem. The most you're ever given is 100% problem. Because what creates the problem is your own maturity. And you can never have a real problem beyond your maturity. You can imagine one, but then that's an illusion, and you can train yourself to see through illusion. But you cannot, there's no amount of training that can train you to see through reality. You can't evade that. That's there. It is there. So we need to understand now how history works in two different ways. One for us, what is my history as an individual? And two, what is history in the largest form? And history in the largest form by the 20th century is called history of ideas, not history of nations, not history of anything smaller than the history of ideas. And so self-realization and the history of ideas are correlates. They're two wheels of a chariot. They're two patterns that go together. And you progress in one as you progress in the other, in a balanced way. If you put the emphasis on one or the other, you tend to fall into a sand trap, as it were. Use a golf metaphor here. If you develop a sense of history, of ideas, without self-development, you end up in a kind of an abstract jungle. And if you develop self-realization without the sense of the history of ideas, you end up abstracting yourself away from life. And you don't have to go very far on any particular yoga to discover that you can effectively cut yourself off from everything. You can not only stop smoking, you can stop eating. You can pursue the methodology of yoga to any extent that you want. You can cut yourself off from your heartbeat, like that. There have been some master yogis in the human race who have simply petrified their whole body, ossified their whole body. The great author of all those big volumes on science and civilization in China, Joseph Needham, who was the master of Caius College in Cambridge University in England, has in one of those volumes a photograph that he took of himself, of the great Tang Dynasty Zen master Hui Ning, who, when he died in deep meditation, and he petrified his body. It turned the consistency of a kind of an anthracite coal. And the body still exists. It's physically there. He took the photograph himself in 1942. You can pursue a yoga to that extent. It doesn't add anything to livingness. It just shows what a fantastic yogi you were. big deal. The knack is to be able to live your life full and not just to fortify your ego capacity to the nth degree. History is that transformational media where this happens. And it's what was the underside of myth. In between is the experience of shifting from image to ideas. History moves by ideas, just like myth moved by images. So I'm going to remind you by giving you something that we had in the symbols section of the course. This was about 9 months ago. The symbol is the integral culmination of nature, brought into a focus at the soul center of the human psyche. Symbols do not represent something else or anything else. They present themselves. And that is the focused meaning which they are. The self symbol is the archetypal symbol on this scale of comprehension. There is only one real archetypal symbol on this scale, and that is the total self, or the deep self, if you like. Each one has one, and that one is one of the one, capital O. The stuff of a symbol, its content is meaning. A symbol is made up of pure meaning, and this meaning has been generated in some kind of a language from an image base in the mythic horizon. So the meaningfulness of a symbol is tied into its integrated image base. Thus, symbols control images, and the self symbol controls all of the orders of images, so that images are put into image bases, and those image bases are controlled by symbols, and the deep self controls all the symbols, and thus, by implication, eventually all of the images. This is why the experience of the deep self is so astoundingly protean, because any image whatsoever that exists could be used to express some aspect of it. The traditional expression is that one is stunned, astonished into silence. It's not that there isn't anything to say, it's that whatever you would say would be meaningful. Even gibberish, from that perspective, would still be meaningful. Some people just simply laugh, because it is just, it's too much for words, literally. So that integration has brought this juxtaposition, this relation. And this relation is so precise that the various elements are always related in terms of ratios. There's always a rationality, a ratio-ness to any of the elements. And of course, the self element would be like 1/1. And 1/1 does not turn out to be 1, it turns out to be 0. It has a very peculiar quality. Integration then has brought juxtaposition and relation, ratios, the gestalts into form as a symbolic vision, or sometimes the kind of language that you should use here is a symbolic vision matrix, because it isn't just the vision, but it's the possibility of all possible visions. The mathematical term matrix is very adequate to this. Here is the birth, the generator, the maker of ideas. And the Greek term for maker on this scale was poiesis, from which we get the English term poetry. All real soul-making is poetry. This is why the personality which is made by the soul is beautiful, is indeed angelic being. Because this kind of making is a creative, real making. It's a poesis, a poetry. And there is a poetry of ideas. So that ideas are seeds in the symbolic. Ideas and images mix and match in symbols. And meaning is preserved in the symbol by sealing an image relationship, like in an amulet. You can actually seal meaning and keep it. You can make various amulets human beings always have, and they seal that meaning, and the meaning is there. It protects it. But just to make amulets like in a physical way is to misunderstand, because it isn't just to make amulets in a physical way, but you can make the amulets inside of yourself. You can seal those meaning forms and shapes inside of yourself. Now you can make an amulet out of silver, and it will last for several billions of years till silver finally decays. But if you make those amulets in yourself, they're eternal. They never decay. There's no way for them to decay. They don't have any half life. They have only a whole life. So it's better to do it for real, and not just to make things. Things are good examples for those learning, but they're not adequate really to live with. But just as there are amulets that can be made, meaning that is sealed within and protected, there are forms of sealing meaning in such a way that the meaning radiates out. And these are the talismans. So that amulets contain meaning safely hidden within, and talismans project meaning. And when they project meaning, they project all of the meaning securely bound in that form. So they don't just project meaning data bit by data bit, but they project the whole gestalt, all at the same time. This is a phenomenon in nuclear physics known as the soliton. In other words, there's a coherence that happens related to an inverse scattering tendency. Instead of it being scattered proportionately, it's a sealed proportionately. It's very difficult to understand in terms of math and science, but don't worry about it right now. We've got plenty of time to go through that. So attaining symbolic realization is the culmination of a whole natural ecology. Nature, ritual, myth, and symbol. This is the first quaternary. But because that first quaternary is alive, there's a second quaternary that occurs, and that second quaternary is what we colloquially, in a normal kind of a language way, call consciousness. So that consciousness comes out of nature and yet is somehow different from it. Man as man, as a self-conscious being, tends to identify himself in terms of that second quaternary more and more, and tends to see that first quaternary as out there. So by the time psychic energy is working in a kind of a self-conscious way, nature becomes unconscious. And if you were to make a cross-section of the psyche of a magician, you would find ritual and myth and symbol and magic, but no nature. And if you would make a cross-section of the psyche of an artist, you would find myth and symbol and magic and art. But not only is nature tend to be invisible, but ritual tends to be invisible too. A real artist just doesn't consciously relate to ritual at all. They relate to what they're doing now, not to any ritual. And just so, when you get to historical consciousness, when you get to that sophisticated level, what begins to become invisible is myth. But if you took a cross-section of someone who is historically conscious, you would find symbol and magic and art and history. Notice that one is beginning to get to a very precarious kind of situation where the whole ground base, the whole foundational floor of what you consider to be real begins to be jeopardized at the stage of history. Because you can see now that if you grow one more step, what is going to become invisible? Your symbolic base. So that if you took the cross-section of the psyche of someone who is completely conscious, you would find magic and art and history and science, and the whole first quaternary would be completely subconscious, invisible. So that if you were not prepared in a wisdom teaching way to know that it's still there, even though it's just invisible, you would panic. You'd panic long before you get to science. You would panic about the time that your historical self-consciousness got sophisticated enough to understand what was happening to you. This in the actual past, actual human history, is what happened to human beings. All societies, all civilizations balked at making this step. All of them gagged at it. Because they all considered that this next step would be a kind of a death. The only people who ever did this were the mystics and yogis, the religious geniuses. Were occasionally there are some people like the 19th century figure Ramakrishna who were just mutants. They were simply born this way, born with God consciousness. They never didn't know anything else. They were just that way. It occasionally happened. So there is a very precariousness that occurs in historical consciousness that does not occur anywhere else. And one idea comes to dominate the historical consciousness more than any other idea, and that is the idea of death. All of the ideas that could be there and are working, the more that one comes to realization what's going on, the more that comes to haunt one is the idea of death. And the correlate of that in the cultural pattern is the more and more society begins to mature to the point to having a science, the more it is haunted by the specter of universal death. And the tack taken, in every case, is the tack taken by the Egyptians. It's a human way of getting around this. You put the spiritual science in death instead of in life. You put all of your spiritual science endeavor into it, preparing for a death realm rather than a life realm. It's an ingenious ploy, but nevertheless it is a ploy. It does not bring science into life. And it initiates this kind of regression. And there's no way around it. If you don't grow, you will not stay where you are, you will go back. You will go back to some stable level where you were comfortable before. But you're not going to be comfortable again. You can't go back and be comfortable being 8 years old again. You just can't. And you can't go back being a blasé, sophisticated 19 anymore. You just can't do that. Because you know too much. You've seen too much. You know that that's not all that there is. And to try and squeeze yourself back into those inadequate forms, and they are by now just masks to you, means that you're caught in a situation where you're trying to play a role again, and you're too large an actor for that role. And what occurs to you more and more is that this is just a bit part. And you know yourself how much you resent somebody else trying to foist a bit part on you as your life function, when you realize that it's your own self that's forcing this bit part upon yourself, you grow to be an adversary to your own self. And it's just this way that one enters into a whole swampy area of self-sabotage, which gets ingenious and finally effective. One finally does manage to sabotage oneself. All of this is there in history, in the historical consciousness. All of this needs to be dealt with in a very comprehensive way. And the comprehensive way that we have in this education program is to see that this whole area is but one more stage, one more phase in a developmental problem that we are unfolding. To understand every stage, every state had its own particular problem. This is the problem of history. The problem of history resides then in trying to understand how to develop your self-consciousness in such a way that you can include the idea of your own death and not be fearful about that. That's what it turns out to be. Now, I've given you a handout from one of our books in the history, which is very difficult to find, I guess. If you would just take a look at pages 6 through the middle of 14, and we'll come to this next week, starting at Dilthey's methodology, number 5 going up to number 8. Just take a look at it. You don't have to understand it. Just take a look at it and try and familiarize yourself. I'll bring it out. I have enough background and experience. I can bring the meaning out of this very easily and adequately for you. For those who are just starting, this is a good place to start because it starts at the most difficult apex of all. It's better just to drop off the edge, first of all, because it's much easier just to drop. If you knew the water was that cold, you wouldn't jump in. But just by jumping in, you can see that what's to do is to make for sure. And that's a very good reaction. So give a hand at this and see what you can do. Now, next week we'll also take a little time after the break. Most of you have been working at your personal histories. That is to say, you're trying to think back over the last year and a half. What has happened to me in the last year and a half? Putting it in some kind of chronological order. What happened to me last January 1st? What happened to me a year ago, January 1st? And all the way up until today. Just reviewing an outline, what has happened to you? And just jotting down and writing down for yourself that kind of chronology. And if you do that, even in such an offhanded way that you just take a couple of hours to do that and lay out that chronology, then put over the top of that chronology the developmental layout of our sequence, you will be able to see that even though you were not conscious of it, there was a very specific development occurring. There's a form, a shape to that development that leads directly to you being here. It's just like you were living life without a thought that there's anything happening in any kind of an ordered, measured way. You're just living your life. But if you put this kind of a template, this kind of eternal pattern on top of that chronological sequence, you'll see that indeed you were living out this unfolding. And that's why you're here. You're here on this Saturday morning at this specific place because your inner seeker was heading towards this juncture in the first place. The question that comes up, is this true? And the answer is yes.
Yes, it's true.
More next week.